session number 27075, reel 20.
Gordon Lidler, I get reel 20.
You were just telling me about the censoring and that there's a large pile of it. Mm. Who would censor your own mail?
Oh, we were supposed to be trustworthy. Whether it ever was censored, I dare say they pull a few out. But as far as officially we were regarded as being trustworthy. And not to include anything that shouldn't be there, and I think probably most people observe that.
Can I ask a little bit about the ground crew as well? How did that differ? Because you explained to me earlier on, obviously, how the ground crew functioned while you were in the UK during the latter part of the Battle of Britain and early while you've been training. Mm. How did it function in Malta, and was there any significant differences in how they operated?
No, there wasn't really. Certainly not in fighter squadrons. Things may have been rather different in the bomber squadrons, particularly on the servicing side. But ours was a routine. We used what was called a Form 700, that is the serviceability state of an aircraft, and records everything that's done to that aeroplane. It's a logbook, really, for an aeroplane. There would be a fitter and a rigger to each hurricane. Each flight would have a radio technician, an armourer, an instrument mechanic. I think that was it.
Because I was just wondering, obviously, when you took off and you had that encounter with the Messerschmitts, you had a problem, obviously, the radio wasn't functioning, and you said oxygen bottle hadn't been filled.
That's right. Well, this was simply because we were switched from Dakali to Lucca at short notice. I think what happened, there'd been heavy rain, and the airfield was very, very muddy, and I think it was thought that we could manage to operate, but it soon became clear that we could just about get off, but landing was out of the question. So we were simply packed off quickly to get across to Lucca. It's only 3 or 4 miles between Dakali and Lucca. It shouldn't have taken long for the troops to get their trucks together and get the gear over, because they had to load all the starter racks and all the bits and pieces, their tools and everything, and get it over there quickly. And as it happened, before we were properly ready, we were scrambled. Strictly speaking, I should not have been given that aircraft until the flight commander had seen the Form 700 signed up that the aircraft had been serviced, i.e. that would include checking the radio and, of course, changing the oxygen bottle. But that hadn't been done. And it's not surprising in the turmoil of the scramble, the fact that my aircraft had not been serviced wasn't noticed. So off we went. But the day-to-day workings of a squadron would be much the same anywhere in the world, really. The ground crew would get down there early in the morning. They'd do their daily inspection, which was fairly brief, but it covered all the essential points. They had to make sure all the controls were working smoothly and operating correctly. They had to check that the undercarriages were properly locked, that the flaps were retracted, that hoods and canopies could be opened easily, things of that nature, the basic things. That was the daily inspection. And indeed, pilots were encouraged to do their own, or at least walk around with the mechanic while they were doing it, and point out, if necessary, things that appeared to need attention.
How were aircraft allocated? Because obviously at that stage you just...
Yes, flight commander, the way it would work First thing in the morning, the flight sergeant would bring in the bundle of 700s for all the aircraft that had been serviced. 700s were signed up, and they'd be given to the flight commander. Blackboard would be up on the wall there with the aircraft letters, with the it'd be blank, in fact, at that stage. And flight command simply chalk in pilot's name and the aircraft letter beside it. And that would just be up on the board there. We'd all go and have a peer and see which aircraft we'd got. And some chaps say, oh, good, I like that one. Others say, well, God, have I got that clapped out radio thing again? I can't say I knew much about this one that I eventually jumped out with.
With that, would it always be on a sort of lottery basis? He just the first one he picked. There wouldn't be anybody allocated specific aircraft, would there?
Squadron commanders wherever. Most squadron commanders had their own aircraft, usually, and most flight commanders had their own aircraft. The more senior, long-toothed members of the squadron would like to lay claim to an aircraft, and indeed the flight commander would concede that it wasn't unreasonable that senior members should have the same aircraft wherever possible. But of course we were working on this two-shift system, which meant that nobody had exclusive use of an aircraft. It was always being used by the other team. And undoubtedly, if there's anything was found to be wrong with it, it was always the idiot who'd been flying it before who'd mucked it up. But, of course, that all changed when we began to get short of aeroplanes, as indeed we did, because there were going to be times as we got into 1942 when we couldn't scrape together 12 aircraft. We could maybe scrape together 9, possibly 10. But as time went on, it got less and less. And it wasn't unusual for a squadron to comprise 4 aeroplanes. So what aircraft there were would be in the hands of the flight commander to issue to whom he thought was most deserving. On the whole, I think flight commanders were pretty fair and give everybody a fair crack of the whip.
So in essence, it would be much luck of the draw to which aircraft you were allocated that day. It would be the luck of the draw to which aircraft you were allocated.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. There were times when it was possible to give the same aircraft to the same pilot, but not by any right. It might just be that's the way it shaped out, that I could have C for Charlie for the next few trips, and then for some reason or other I'd be given something else.
Might seem a bit of a strange question, but do aircraft have characters in the same way that sailors claim that ships have characters?
Not to the same extent. Generally, it was a matter of rigging and trimming the aeroplane. Of course, these days, or in those days, with a fixed-wing aeroplane, there's no adjustment one can make. The wings are locked in place. But in the days of the old biplanes with their struts and wires and so on, the rigger was very much a rigger, and he had to get the whole thing flying absolutely properly. The most noticeable thing would be that one wing would tend to fly lower than the other one. You were constantly having to pull the thing out. Well, that was because the rigger hadn't quite got it right. But, of course, in the pre-war days, there was plenty of time to sort things like that out. But it didn't apply in the same way, simply because we got fixed wings. But the controls could differ slightly from one aircraft to another. The feel of the controls could be slightly different. Some would be a little more flimsy, others might be a bit on the stiff side. And generally speaking, if one was flying the same aircraft for a while, a word with the rigger and he'd attempt to adjust it, and next time he went up or next time he came down, was that any better, sir? They're always keen to improve things if they could. But of course there wasn't a great deal of scope beyond the adjustments that could be made to the controls. And the sort of thing you might get, perhaps the undercarriage lever got a bit stiff, or maybe got tended to jam or stick. And the flap lever the same. Sometimes the throttle might be on the stiff side or a bit lumpy. Yes, you'd get that sort of thing creeping in. And undoubtedly some aircraft some aircraft would have a bad reputation, shall we say. Most of them were reasonably good, although once we got into 1942, then some of them were beginning to get very tired. Some of the engines in particular, and some of them, although they could attempt to make adjustments to make them fly more smoothly, they were just getting a bit past it.
What would the lifespan really be for a Hurricane on Malta?
Ooh. That's hard to say, because could arrive one day and be pipped off the next quite easily.
I was thinking of one that would not be damaged, but would
keep going.
Yeah.
Mechanically. I was just trying to remember the servicing schedule. I can't remember what it was beyond the daily inspection. There would be the various degrees of servicing, of course. But I can't recall just what those degrees would be, but it would be something like a daily inspection was basic to every day, regardless of how many hours it flew and so on. The next level would be after 20 hours, rather like in a car, you know, after 20 hours, this and this and this would be inspected. You go to the next level and it'd be a longer list until eventually you've got major servicing, at which point the aircraft would be taken off the squadron, or at least taken off the squadron line, and put into the second line servicing section for whatever was due on those flying hours. My guess would be that there'd be something fairly major after 60 hours. So you see, a sortie would generally be, if you went through my book, you'd see that most sorties were round about the hour. It'd be unusual to go over 1 hour and a half, unless one was doing some particular operation.
Where would the second line servicing and deeper servicing take place?
Well, wherever. In Malta, we had no hangars. It would just be literally in an area where servicing was taking place. Now, whether I think they must have had a tent or two over there. But it was all done virtually in the open. In fact, in the desert, everything was done in the open. You can see pictures of the servicing being carried. It looks absolutely hair-raising. A whole blooming engine with it, everything stripped off it, all bits and pieces of an aeroplane lying around in the sand. But somehow they managed to get them back into business and get them flying again. It must have been a nightmare, though, particularly if the weather was poor and windy and so on, dust and sand flying everywhere. It's a miracle, really, that they did keep going as long as they did.
Because I was interested when you said that the airfield got waterlogged, and there was, you said it was okay taking off, but it would be more difficult landing. Why is there a difference?
Just that the thing would sink as you touch down. Taking off, you'd open up the engines pretty quickly, and get the tail wheel up as quickly as you could, and get the thing to unstick. Whereas landing, you're going to mush down into it, and the probability is that because you're slowing down, it's going to tilt and tilt until eventually she just goes straight over on her nose. Taking off, of course, you're going the other way. You're getting the nose up, and you want it to come up. But
with Luca, then, was that a different runway? Obviously, was it the construction of the runway? Was it a concrete runway at Luca?
Yes, it was a hard runway at Luca. In fact, I think they had two hard runways. Halfar was also. It was grass. It was the old Navy airfield, complete Iran. So, where have we got to?
Well, I was just going to ask you actually about a little bit about the social life as well, because you mentioned odd bits when you've gone into the letter, but at the end of the flying day, where would you go, and what would you do? You mentioned little bits already, but were there any haunts you would have that you pilots would go to?
Yes, the favourite was Captain Caruana's Bar. This is in Kingsway, the main street. And bars in Malta tend to be quite small, quite a smallish room, which led straight off the pavement. Rather like, have you been to Ireland? You know what pubs like, they would step straight off the pavement into a comparatively small room, usually smoke-filled and noisy. Caruana's wasn't smoke-filled or noisy, at least not unduly so. But it was a favourite haunt of certainly of my squadron, or certainly of my flight commander Johnny Beasley. Oh, and Pissy Davies. They liked Caruana's. And if I or one of the others were passing, stuck a head in the door and probably got called in for a drink. So that was the the first line of entertainment. Then there were the cinemas. There were several cinemas used, and quite reasonable films as far as I recall. So that was quite good. In the summer we'd go down to sea bathing. We could go and swim off the rocks with the Policino girls up to Slema, or we could go to the two beaches. The best one was Antofia, the north end of the island, which is a nice beach, good sandy beach. It's got a big hotel on it now, of course. So we'd swim there, get the little old bus back with some Fords. And then there were the Harbour Bar. The Harbour Bar was at St. Paul's Bay. And St. Paul's Bay is a lovely little inlet, rocky. No swimming there, but there was a little boat we could sail. That was quite good fun. Nice little sailing dinghy. And there was a pub called the Harbour Bar. And there, they had a good selection of wine. There's quite a lot of wine to be had in Malta. Fish. And the fish would come straight out of the harbour. Very often it would come in wheeling. And we'd say, we want some fish. Say, yes, sir, I bring you fish. And they come with a big tray with all these fishes wiggling about on it. And we'd say, I have that one, I have that one. And off they'd trot, and we'd drink some more wine or local beer or whatever we fancied. And the fish would come, and it was a good evening, yeah. Very often we'd walk home, quite a long walk. or stay there. We had they had a few rooms at the we had a rest house there. That's right. We had a rest house which had accommodation for about eight, I think. So that was good. Or if it was nightlife in Valletta, well, the nightlife in Valletta you may have heard of, quite notorious. It's called the Strada Stretta, the street called Straight. And this is the brothel area. The whole length of the street, right the way along both sides, are these brothels. They all go under different names, and rather like the buses, they all have a different theme. Quite unbelievable, some of it. You can imagine some of the illustrations on the walls. And there'd always be music of one kind or another, very often a small band, jazz band or something. Well, one in particular, I remember there was a drummer, and he was a one-man act, and he was absolutely fantastic. He could drum anything out of sight. Now this was the street called Straight. I was able to speak of it from personal experience because after the war, one was allowed to go in the street called Straight, but during the war, it was reserved for the other ranks, and there was no argument about that. That was their preserve. Soldiers, sailors, Orient had free run of the Strada Stretta and all that went with it, and Lord help them. And
was there any kind of organised kind of concert party type things that you would have?
Yes, around? I think we did have an Insa party. I think we did. We certainly had them in other places. We certainly had Insa in the desert, and later on in Ceylon of all places. But I think maybe we did have one on the airfield. But more particularly, we'd go to Valletta if it was going to be a night show, and there were one or two cabarets there. Not a very high standard, but we'd go and dive there. But if it was an afternoon show, we were all very polite, and we'd go to the British Council Club. And the attraction there was the girls. And they knew that the chaps were going to be in the British Council at tea time. So the girls used to flock there, and the chaps used to flock there as well. So we got to know quite a few girls one way or another. But we'd been warned at the outset by the Provost Marshal, no less. We were all paraded in front of him when we first arrived. And he stood in the back of a truck and addressed everybody and told us all about the evils of the letter, and particularly Strada Stretta, and all the terrible things that could happen to a chap who went there. It was all really innocent stuff.
It sounds like entertainment, though, continued throughout the whole siege, Jeff.
I departed before it really got serious in April. In my time, we would be in Valletta, and the odd Italian would come over and drop a few bombs haphazardly. But it was never a serious raid. It was all very spasmodic. And we might be down there. There was Tony's Cabaret, which was quite a good drinking spot. But if the bombs started to come down, it was more often than not more of a distant crump than a crash outside the door. So in my time, it was no great problem. But I'm quite sure as time went on and the whole thing intensified, I think probably it was fairly unwise to spend too much time in there, certainly anywhere near the dock area.
And who would you mix with, obviously, in the, would it be your fellow pilots, or would it be with other officers as well from other services?
sometimes one would find oneself leaning against a bar, and they might, well, in point of fact, that the captain of the Dorsets who picked me up when I bailed out, we were just standing side by side in the bar and had a few bit of natter, and I dare say we bought each other a drink, and then sort of drifted elsewhere. It just happened that he happened to turn up. Quite extraordinary.
And what were you drinking? What would be your favourite kind of drink?
The big favourite was John Collins. You know John Collins? I'm not terribly sure of the recipe now, but it's John Collins. You can have a John or a Tom. I think John Collins was brandy based, and I think Tom Collins was gin based, if I remember rightly. And then it would be fruit juices of various sorts, chunks of ice, various garnishing and so on. It was a long, cool, not too innocuous drink. I think we could put away a few of those. Rye and dry tended to be the American drink. They all term rye and dry. And yes, we got one or two. We had one or two Americans in the squadron. I think they all got killed except one, and his name was Coffin.
What would you drink while you're on the airfield? Would you have? I mean, because obviously you could have it with ice in Valletta when you're in the evening. But would you have anything to cool your drinks, or would you drink tea? Or
I'm not sure. We must have drunk something. It wouldn't be alcohol, of course. Did we drink? Maybe we didn't. Oh, I think it must have been fruit juices, I suppose. Or tea. But it doesn't seem to be, in my recollection, a major part of the exercise.
Would you have had a naffy van or something like that?
Yes, the naffy would come round, and yes, of course, that's it. Naffy would come round and produce whatever we wanted. It was nearly always tea, I think. Certainly the troops all drank tea all the time. It was char and wads. Char is the tea. It's almost black. And wads are these great thick bun things, great chunk of dough, you know, with currants in it. So it was char and wads. And yes, no doubt the naffy van had got fruit juices as well. I think that's what I suppose we just lasted out. The naffy came round in the crew room. Well, we did have cooking facilities. There's a picture here, in fact. That was the sort of catering we went in for. Not very elaborate.
The use of a small gas burner type thing.
Something like that, yes.
Would you look after yourselves, or would there be somebody to look after you in the crew room?
There'd be an orderly. Yes, there'd be a telephone orderly in the crew room. But his job was, of course, to telephone, but I think probably did the washing up and anything like that that was needed. There'd be a runner. Johnny Bees's favourite prank was call this chap over and say, "Are you the runner?" "Yes, sir." "Then ready, steady, go." "Beg pardon, sir." "Ready, steady, go."
I was wondering if there was any kind of with this as well, in the passing of the time, if you played jokes on each other, or if there were pranks or that sort of thing while you were waiting at dispersal or in the evenings in town.
No, possibly, but nothing very malicious as far as I can remember. I don't think so. No, I think on the whole we tended to be fairly self-contained. This may have been because of the nature of life we were leading. We mixed with each other all the time, and in the air we would depend on each other, but I don't think we depended on each other all that much on the ground when we were off duty. We tended, I think, either do our own thing. Some people did a lot of reading. One or two painted, in fact. In fact, there's a couple of pictures there that are paintings, and they were done by a fellow called Anderson, and his uncle was Captain Albert Ball, VC. Yeah, it's his uncle, his mother's brother. And he was, as you can see, they're quite good pictures. He was always painting. So that was the sort of thing. And we'd go, if we're going swimming, we'd usually go in a group, three or four. We took a horse and cart to the beach one day. We rented it off a farmer. He thought we were mad, offering him money for his horse and cart. But he's only too pleased to take the money. And we told him we'd be home before it was dark. Oh, that is all right. Yes, you come home before dark. That's all right.